Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group is hosting a debate on the issue of Internet sales tax. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. My name is Kristen Hickman. I'm an associate professor of law at the University of Minnesota Law School, and I will be the moderator of today's debate. We are fortunate to have with us two very distinguished panelists. First, we have Mr. Bruce Johnson. Mr. Johnson is a commissioner of the Utah State Tax Commission, a position in which he has served since 1998. The Tax Commission is comprised of four commissioners who have the constitutional duty to administer and supervise all of the tax laws of the state of Utah, including property tax, income tax, franchise tax, sales tax, and all miscellaneous taxes. The commissioners promulgate rules, advise the legislature and governor on tax issues, and adjudicate tax disputes. Mr. Johnson was the founding national co-chair of the Streamlined Sales Tax Implementing States, a group of over 40 states working with taxpayers to simplify compliance with state and local sales taxes across the country. He now serves on the executive committee of the Streamlined Sales Tax Governing Board. Second, our second panelist today, we have Mr. Grover Norquist. Mr. Norquist is president of Americans for Tax Reform, a coalition of taxpayer groups, individuals, and businesses opposed to higher taxes at the federal, state, and local levels. He is author of the book entitled Leave Us Alone, Getting the Government's Hands Off Our Money, Our Guns, Our Lives. Prior to his position at Americans for Tax Reform, Mr. Norquist served as a commissioner on the Advisory Commission on Electronic Commerce and the National Commission on Restructuring the Internal Revenue Service. He was also an economist and chief speechwriter at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and has served as executive director of the National Taxpayers Union. Gentlemen, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Again, our topic today is taxation of Internet sales. Sales taxes represent a significant revenue source for state and local governments. We have all been in situations where we go to a store to purchase one item or another, and part of the price we pay is sales and local sales tax equal to a percentage of the item's purchase price. At least since the case of Quill Corp versus North Dakota in 1992, and even as far back as National Bellas Hess, Inc. versus Department of Revenue of State of Illinois in 1967, the Supreme Court has held that a vendor has had to have a physical presence in a state for that state to require the vendor to collect sales taxes on purchases made by residents of that state. In theory, in most if not all states, customers who purchase goods from an out-of-state vendor and do not have to pay sales tax are supposed instead to pay use tax directly to the state. But use tax laws are notoriously under-enforced. Meanwhile, the explosion of electronic commerce has dramatically increased the number of sales that, in light of Quill, are exempt from the state sales tax system. One study of which I am aware estimates that by 2012, e-commerce will cause annual state and local tax losses from sales taxes of $11.4 to $12.65 billion. Beginning with the Internet Tax Freedom Act in 1998, Congress has repeatedly passed legislation imposing moratoria on multiple and discriminatory taxes on Internet sales, which generally includes state and local sales taxes. The Internet Tax Freedom Act Amendment Act of 2007 was signed into law by President George W. Bush in 2007 and extends the moratorium until 2014. Meanwhile, the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement Project has endeavored to harmonize state sales and use tax systems to get around the limitations of the Quill case and mitigate or eliminate some of the concerns motivating the moratorium. Having presented this background, I would now like to turn things over to our panelists, beginning with Bruce Johnson.
Thank you. Imagine you're a retailer conducting business by phone, internet, or mail order throughout the United States. Should you be required to collect sales tax for as many as 6,000 jurisdictions? That's the question asked of the United States Supreme Court 17 years ago. And as our moderator stated, in Quill versus North Dakota, the court answered no. They acknowledged that such a requirement would not violate the Due Process Clause, thus partially overturning their prior decision in National Bellas Hess. They also acknowledged that the case may have been decided differently, but for stare decisis, and the settled expectations of the mail order industry. Finally, they noted that their decision was easier because Congress could so easily mandate a different result. The court did reaffirm, however, that it was an impermissible burden on interstate commerce to require a seller to collect a state sales tax if the seller had no physical presence in the state. It's clear that the court was not overly concerned with North Dakota's law. What was more significant was that similar obligations might be imposed by the nation's 6,000-plus taxing jurisdictions, and that, quote, many variations in rates of tax, in allowable exemptions, and in administrative and record-keeping requirements could entangle a mail-order house in a virtual welter of complicated regulations, end quote. Well, the solution is now at hand. The streamlined sales tax system drastically reduces the welter of obligations, and if adopted by all states, could reduce our remote retailers' filing obligations to as little as one return per period, and would drastically reduce the number of different tax bases and exemptions the retailer would have to deal with. Discussion of sales tax simplification has been ongoing ever since Quill, but has been spurred on in recent years with the increase in electronic purchasing. Significant work was done by the Advisory Commission on Electronic Commerce, established by the Internet Tax Freedom Act. Mr. Norquist, in fact, was an active member of the ACEC. Now, because of the relative ease with which remote retailers can meet the safe harbor of Quill, and the relative difficulty, costs, and invasions of privacy inherent in actively enforcing a consumer use tax, former Governor Leavitt of Utah, also an ACEC delegate, posed the question of whether the sales tax is a viable source of revenue in the 21st century. The answer, we believe, is yes, but only if the states work together to drastically simplify their sales tax systems and to ameliorate the burdens that have been imposed on retailers over the years. The SST project is administered by a governing board whose current president is Delegate John Doyle of West Virginia. The governing board is comprised of delegates from 19 full member states and 4 associate member states who are either state legislators or tax administrators. Virtually all other sales tax states, with the exception of Colorado, have participated in the meetings in an advisory or observer capacity. In addressing the inaugural project meeting, former Governor Leavitt of Utah, also a member of the ACEC panel, urged that all participants de-emphasize their roles as tax administrators, legislators, or business people, and to think of themselves instead as delegates of their states working on a historic project in the best tradition of federalism. In that spirit, the governing board has been working closely with the private sector to design, test, and implement a streamlined sales tax system for the 21st century. The streamlined sales tax agreement, formally adopted in November of 2002, addresses 3 fundamental problems in sales tax administration. First, the uneven playing field. There's an uneven playing field between Main Street retailers and remote retailers. They sell the same products to the same customers, but the Main Street retailer has a collection obligation imposed on it by the state, a burden that the remote retailer does not have. We are all familiar with stories of shoppers who browse in local stores, often picking the brains of knowledgeable salespeople who may rely on commissions for their livelihoods, and then go buy the chosen item over the Internet to get a cost savings. The second problem is complexity, the one that was addressed by the Supreme Court in Quill. It is tremendously difficult for a multi-state taxpayer to comply with the sales tax laws of thousands of different jurisdictions. Before I joined the Tax Commission, I was in private practice for 17 years, representing large taxpayers, most of whom had interstate operations. It was very difficult for them to fully comply. The state of Colorado, for example, has one set of criteria for exempt organizations. The city and county of Denver had a narrower set of criteria. I had a client who was assessed a deficiency because the client didn't realize that the exemption certificate received for the state wouldn't work for the city. Similarly, different jurisdictions had different definitions for similar projects. Fruit juice might be exempt food in one state and a taxable soft drink in another state because one state requires 50% fruit juice while the other state requires 80%. The third problem is the loss of tax revenue to the states. In my view, this is the least serious of the 3 problems, but it is the problem that is giving the states the political will to make the difficult changes necessary to conform their laws to the SST agreement. Our moderators already referred to the recent study from professors Bill Fox, Don Bruce, and Leanne Luna at the University of Tennessee, which indicates that the losses to all jurisdictions over the next 6 years from electronic commerce alone could exceed $50 billion. The losses in 2012 alone are estimated to be between $11.4 and $12.6 billion. By 2012, these losses could be as much as 4 to 5% of total sales and use tax revenue. And those numbers are from electronic commerce alone. If mail order and other remote sales are added, the amount could conceivably double, with some states losing as much as 10% of their revenue. The goal of the governing board is to come up with a sales tax system that's easy to understand, simple to administer, and fair to everyone. The board recognizes the very real revenue implications to taxpayers and to state and local governments of any change in the system. Thus, our responsibility is to craft a system that has enough flexibility that a substantial number of states will be willing to participate, but the system must be simple enough to substantially reduce the burden on all retailers, especially those involved in interstate commerce. If the resulting system is not simple enough, the agreement will not gain the support of the business community and will not satisfy a court or Congress that interstate commerce is no longer unduly burdened by nationwide sales tax compliance. Thus, the input and support of large segments of the business community has been crucial to our progress so far and will be crucial and critical to our future success. The agreement takes a threefold approach to addressing these problems. First, simplification. If a provision can be simplified, it should be. Thus, the agreement generally requires a single tax rate per jurisdiction. You cannot charge 2% tax on clothing and a 4% tax on motorboats. The greatest level of simplification, however, will come from the decision to require a single statewide sales tax base and a single point of administration for all state and local sales taxes in a given state. Thus, although Kansas and Utah may have different tax bases, Kansas's base and Topeka's base must be identical. Similarly, Utah sales tax base and Salt Lake City's tax base must be identical. A single tax sales tax return will be used for both Kansas and Topeka, as well as other local jurisdictions in Kansas. Similarly, a single return may be used for both Utah and Salt Lake City taxes. Taxpayers will be submitted to no more than one audit per state, and perhaps less if they use a certified service provider or certified software. The second prong is uniformity. Where things cannot be made simpler, they can often be made uniform. For example, in exemptions, state will retain considerable flexibility with product-based exemptions. The agreement, however, requires uniform definitions for some of those exemptions. States will be able to toggle on or toggle off such exemptions. Thus, Minnesota and New Jersey may exempt clothing. Utah would not have to. But if Minnesota and New Jersey choose to exempt clothing, they must adopt the clothing definition in the agreement. Thus, if a certain product is clothing in Minnesota, it will also be clothing in New Jersey. Finally, technology. Some things are difficult to simplify and politically cannot be made uniform. The governing board, for example, made the decision to allow each local jurisdiction to retain its own tax rate, although it does place limits on how often and when such rates can be changed. The agreement, however, requires the states to have a downloadable database that contains all the jurisdictional boundaries and tax rates in the state. If a retailer relies on that database and there is an error, the retailer will be held harmless. Finally, the governing board has certified a group of certified sales tax providers and certified tax compliance software. If a retailer uses the software or retains a CSP, it is held harmless for any deficiencies that may result. Most importantly, if the retailer does not have physical presence in a state, the state will actually compensate the CSP for providing the service to the retailer. The retailer can use the CSP, that certified service provider, without cost. There are, of course, strict provisions on taxpayer confidentiality that apply to the CSPs. The system so far is voluntary for remote retailers that are protected by Quill's physical presence test. The states, even acting collectively, cannot overturn a Supreme Court precedent. It's our hope that legislation will be introduced shortly that will effectively ratify the streamlined sales tax agreement and that such legislation will be speedily enacted. The bill would probably be very similar to bills introduced in the last Congress by Senator Enzi, that was S-34, and Representative Delahunt, H.R. 3396. If enacted, the streamlined sales tax project would present a classic example of federalism at its best, states working collectively with their citizens to solve a national problem with the blessing of the U.S. Congress. Thank you.
Mr. Norquist.
Yes, Grover Norquist. I served on the commission, which was established by some in Congress, specifically with the hope that the commission would announce that we should tax internet sales. And the people on the commission majority decided, actually, that that would be a bad idea and rejected the proposals by Governor Leavitt of Utah to do that. And it's quite simple, really. This is the third crisis that we've been exposed to. The first one was politicians at the state level that wanted more money, said that we had to tax businesses in other states that sold things through mail order, because any moment now we'd be buying our ham sandwiches and our cars and our homes out of mail order, and there would be no sales tax revenue in the states because everyone would buy things by mail order. Then there was the argument that we were going to lose all of our sales tax revenue, we being politicians and the people who feed off government spending. We would be losing all of our sales tax revenue because no one was manufacturing goods anymore, and it was all services, and many services are not covered by the sales tax, so we must extend the sales tax to services, something that cost people like Mr. Martinez the governorship of Florida. That was not a very popular move. And now everybody's going to buy everything on the internet, and you see rather big numbers being thrown around, small numbers in terms of overall government spending, the hundreds of billions of dollars that the state governments spend, but some significant numbers. The estimates have tended to fall from what they had been when they were trying to panic people into passing these tax increases on people in other states. We can talk about the effort to impose sales taxes. Alabama would like to impose sales taxes on businesses in New York and Maine and Washington State from somebody in Alabama buys something over the internet from a business in another state, primarily because Alabama politicians have discovered that people who work and build products and sell products in New York and Maine and in Washington State don't vote in Alabama. The idea, the fantasy that we're all going to make $1 trillion taxing people who live in other states and cannot vote against the state legislators who are doing this is driving this. There's not that much money on the table. It would certainly be destructive of federalism and the idea of states competing to provide the best government at the lowest cost. And again, there's a big difference between federalism, which was Ronald Reagan's vision. You want Texas to compete with Michigan by providing good government at less cost. People leave Michigan and they go to Texas because Texas has no income tax. Texas has lower taxes in general. Texas does not let the trial lawyers run through and loot every business in the state the way Michigan does. And this provides better government with 50 states competing. Now, what you have are loser states, Enzi and Delahunt representing two of them, states people leave wanting to be able to extend the ability to tax to those businesses that have moved to other states or have been developed in other states. States that do not see themselves as moving forward over the next decades, there's a reason why this fight comes out of North Dakota. North Dakota taxes people heavily enough that they leave North Dakota, and they would like the senators in that state are strong advocates of reaching out and taxing people in other states. Now, there's really not much money to be made by taxing the sales on the internet, which is why none of this has anything to do with taxing sales taxes on the internet. This is all about getting a redefinition of nexus for purposes of using the individual and corporate income tax. The businessmen in Washington, who are worried that North Dakota will want to tax Exxon's worldwide sales, one of the interesting projects that North Dakota has suggested in the past, that if you have any sort of nexus as defined by them, like selling a gallon of gasoline in North Dakota, they should be able to go after your corporate earnings worldwide. The businesses that feared that have actually gotten together and talked to the people who do the sales tax, and they said, tell you what, we'll give you the sales tax on internet if you will pass a law forbidding the abuse of nexus in taxing individual and corporate income taxes. And the answer back from the labor unions that are pushing this, particularly AFSCME, which want more money for state and local taxes, is no deal. That's the target. So the conversation that you sometimes have with elected officials about sales taxes is a preliminary conversation for changing the nexus and changing the rules so that loser states can tax successful states' earnings in those other states. What we would like, and I represent taxpayers and consumers in saying this, is tax competition between the states. Tax competition We have a federal administration, which is with Obama, which is opposing tax competition internationally because the Europeans like to have very high marginal tax rates, and they consider it cheating if other countries have lower tax rates and investment and people flow to other countries. AFSCME and the teachers' unions and the various government workers' unions and those who benefit from government spending at the local level, getting other people's money, they do not like tax competition because they want to be able to raise taxes on their own citizens and, even better, raising taxes on other citizens in other states and businesses in other states. It's the old saying that, you know, you can't go wrong as a politician voting against Puerto Rico or D.C. because they can't vote. And obviously, if Alabama's politicians vote to make it easier to tax L.L. Bean or Amazon or businesses in other states, those people can't vote against the politicians in Alabama. And you have this tremendous effort by elected officials who don't want to say to their constituents, I shouldn't be spending more money and increasing spending at the state level because we can't afford it. They say, I'm going to spend more, and somebody else is magically going to pay for it. Now, of course, the Alabama politicians who vote to spend more of other people's money and promise the people of Alabama that they will loot Maine and New York and Washington State to pay for this additional cash are forgetting that those people in Alabama who do sell things in other states through the internet will now be looted by politicians in other states. This is how politicians like to raise taxes on hotels, thinking that people from other states will pay for it, and on rental cars, thinking that other people in other states will pay for it, and they can't vote against you. Of course, their constituents, when they travel to other states, have their pockets picked whenever they rent a car or stay at a hotel with very high taxes passed by politicians in those other states telling their constituents, you'll never pay this tax. The idea of allowing politicians to reach into other constituencies and levy taxes on businesses producing those taxes is a problem. Now, we've had this conversation. If a politician in Alabama wants to go knock on people's doors and raise taxes on them because they bought furniture from North Carolina or follow the UPS trucks as they come into town, they're free to do that right now. They don't do that because they know their constituents would be very irritated at them for doing that. They want to do it to other states.
Mr. Johnson, rebuttal?
Well, a couple of points. One, the tax is not imposed typically on the out-of-state retailer. We're talking about a collection obligation. And under, again, one of the key premises of the Streamlined Sales Tax Project is if a retailer wants to use a certified service provider, the certified service provider will be compensated by the states. So what we're trying to do is just level the playing field so there's a collection obligation. We're not trying to impose a Utah sales tax on Amazon. We're trying to make sure that when I buy a book from Amazon, which I do with some regularity, that the sales tax is properly collected.
Does Utah plan on getting that money from you when you buy your book, or do they expect Amazon to collect the money for them?
The program would be and is designed to require Amazon to collect
right.
it.
Okay.
Because that's the most efficient way to do it. Adam Smith in 1776 said that every tax ought to be levied at the time or in the manner in which it is most likely to be convenient for the contributor to pay it. And sales taxes are effective and, in fact, are one of the, I won't say favored, but the least disfavored taxes among consumers and taxpayers because they can see it, the tax is there, they know what they're paying, they can choose to buy the item or not, and the collection is relatively simple. But we have burdened the retailers by having them act as our tax collectors. So the Streamlined Sales Tax system proposes to compensate those retailers for undertaking that obligation. We just want the obligation to be uniformly applied among all the people that are selling goods in our states.
The argument that there's unfair competition among the states. Think about this for a second. You buy $100 worth of books from Utah. Sales tax, what, 6%?
Close enough.
Okay. So that's $6 sales tax if you buy it in Utah from the store. You are now going to buy it from Amazon and get your $100 worth of books, and you have to pay shipping costs. Either you pay them in addition to the $100 or it comes out of the sales cost. You can't ship $100 worth of books for less than $6. You're talking about people who compete with the sales tax burden if you buy in-state, and there's the cost of shipping if you buy from out-of-state.
My downtown bookseller has to pay to get the books to Utah. The books get shipped one way or the other. If Amazon has a competitive advantage because of its bulk sales, it can charge shipping, it can give me free shipping, it does both. I have no problem with a seller who chooses a business model and has the natural economic benefits from that business model. What I do object to is having one subjected to a government-imposed obligation that's not imposed on the other. If Amazon can use their model to provide cheaper books, that's a problem my local bookstore has to deal with. And if they can compete on the basis of better service or more knowledgeable salespeople, you know, that's what the market's about. They have to compete. But I want to make the government-imposed burdens as neutral as possible on both those kinds of sales.
And I want to make them as low as possible on citizens. To make it easy for politicians to raise taxes is a mistake for citizens. The state and local governments are spending about 12% of GDP now. That was closer to 6% 30, 40, 50 years ago. Every state in the nation has dramatically raised their spending over the last 5 years, the last 10 years, the last 20 years, the last 30 years, and quote-unquote services and whatnot are not getting better. The idea that we should be spending any time trying to figure out how to get a couple more percent on the sales tax out of taxpayers in other states so that citizens in our own state would similarly get nicked, that time and effort would be better spent by the politicians trying to decide how to spend the money of their citizens better. And that's the fundamental difference here. Some people are arguing that loser states, states that people leave, should try and figure out how to pick the pockets of states that people move to because they have lower taxes and less regulatory burdens and do not harass their people the way states that chase them out do. This is a function of how do we provide the lowest cost, most competent government at the most reasonable price, and that is to have competition between the 50 states. And what states that view themselves as losers want to do is to extend their state corporate income tax and their state individual income tax into people in other states. The sales tax, there's no real money on the table compared to what can be done with the corporate income tax at the state level and the personal income tax. That's where the real money is, and that's why the people pushing this, AFSCME and the government workers' labor unions, are pushing it. Now, they've taken retailers in sales tax states and basically held them hostage, and with the Stockholm syndrome at work, they've said, if you don't help us tax the workers in Maine to provide money to the guys in Florida, we're going to come in with property taxes and sales taxes and whack you silly. And that's what the local politicians tell the nice guys who run the shopping malls, and they're panicked, and they want to try and feed taxpayers from other states to the local politicians. I've talked to these guys. That's why they get threatened. They're scared to death, but the business community is not interested in feeding other people to the taxpayers. They would like not to get whacked themselves.
Well, your arguments, both of you, do raise an interesting question, because Mr. Johnson has characterized this effort as just a collection effort, essentially seeming to assume that the incidence or the burden of the taxation actually falls on the consumer, whereas the purchaser of the product. Whereas, Mr. Norquist, your argument seems to assume that the incidence or burden of taxation with sales taxes are going to fall on the vendor. And I'm wondering if either of you knows of any studies or has any sense of any sort of analysis that really reaches a conclusion as to economically who truly bears the burden of these taxes.
Well, if you look at one of the questions about auditing, now some states do export their taxes and actually audit some other states in the case of various kinds of taxes on small level. 50 states would have evidently the ability to audit your sales taxes if you sold into 50 states. Right now, if you work in one state's able to audit. Can you imagine getting a letter from the guy running for the director of revenue in Alabama saying, I think you owe us $20,000. Why don't you spend $50,000 or $100,000 sending lawyers down here and disputing that bill? Or you can make a contribution to my campaign for governor, which is only $1,000 and much more reasonable.
Well, that's the beauty of the streamlined sales tax project. If you select a certified service provider, only the certified service provider gets audited. And the whole idea is that you would not be subject to sales tax audits from all these different jurisdictions.
Yeah.
And again, the streamlined sales tax, or the certified service provider, is compensated by the governments, not by the taxpayer.
Okay. That's the effort that you're talking about putting together. But as you know, the modern Democratic Party in Washington, D.C., and the trial lawyers that own their private parts, and the folks in the government workers' unions, their goal is to allow cross-border taxation without all the niceties you're talking about. They're hoping that your effort will convince some businessmen that it's going to be simple enough that they can change the law without getting all the simplification that you walked through, and or go to the courts, if Obama gets a couple more Supreme Court appointments, and get the law changed saying, oh, we fixed that nexus problem. We've simplified it enough. I don't know anybody who actually thinks that the state legislators are going to get to the point that you're talking about, but by talking about getting there, it does fool some people into thinking this is going to be simplified and gives the politicians in Washington, D.C. an excuse to say, okay, you can now tax across state lines, and then all the problems that we foresee will continue. I'm against it if you could do it cleanly, but it's never going to get to clean, because as soon as you start moving in the direction towards what you want, the politicians will say, that's close enough, and they will allow cross-border taxation. And again, this has nothing to do with the sales tax. This is all about the income tax. And the people who think they're doing this on behalf of the sales tax miss that they are pawns in a bigger, much bigger game.
Well, if you look at the recent cases that have been decided on some of the income tax area, the ones that come to mind are MBNA out of West Virginia. I think there was another one out of New Jersey, the Landco case. You know, those cases have held that the QIL test of physical presence doesn't apply to the corporate income tax. And, of course, taxpayers have asked for a cert on those cases, and it's been denied. But
I think you're making my case. You're making my case. That's what they want.
I would agree that there's an issue there. And some of the taxpayers want to use the streamlined sales tax project to trade it against the physical presence test for business activity taxes. You know, we have resisted any linkage. You know, I'm a tax administrator. I don't get to set tax rates, and I don't get to set what's taxed and not. I'm from a very conservative state, but we've got a lot of school kids that we need to educate. And, you know, if the legislators, the elected legislators, want to lower the tax rates, I'm all for that. Again, I spent 17 years representing multi-state businesses. The best reason to do this, in my view, is to level the playing field and simplify things for those retailers. If there are other people out there that have other agendas, you know, all I know is in 10 years, 12 years of working on this project, I haven't ever talked to anybody from AFSCME. I've talked to an awful lot of retailers who have a lot to gain.
But AFSCME are the guys who are planning, the AFSCME, the labor union that represents government workers at the local level, are the engine of this for the modern Democratic Party. They want to raise taxes. They view this as a way to raise taxes. They're not interested in simply changing who pays the taxes or in simplifying anything. When was the last time one of the government workers' labor unions ever expressed any interest in simplifying the burdens put on the business community? This is about getting more cash and ending interstate tax competition. People in loser states do not like the fact that other states can abolish their income tax or reduce their sales tax and bring businesses into their state. They wish to be able to chase people as they leave their state, moving into other states, and tax them. That is what I'm fighting. That is why this effort of trying to tax across state lines is destructive of tax competition. This idea of evening everything up and tax fairness is what tax collectors use in order to even things upwards. Never downwards, always upwards.
I would like to explore a little bit more this concept of an uneven playing field between sort of bricks and mortar businesses and internet businesses. You know, Mr. Johnson, in talking about that uneven playing field and talking about, for example, shipping costs versus taxes, you know, you made an explicit sort of comment about not wanting to interfere with different businesses' business models, and both types of businesses pay shipping costs. But I think that Mr. Norquist does have a point that perhaps the shipping costs of a bricks-and-mortar business might not be the same as the shipping costs of an Amazon that is shipping to myriad of customers. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, how deeply this delves into, say, you know, differences in business models. Because it seems to me, to some extent, that just like, for example, you know, I could go buy a cheaper hammer at Home Depot, or I could go buy the same hammer for more money at my cute neighborhood hardware store with the good customer service and the convenient location, and sometimes I do one and sometimes I do the other. It seems to me, say, for example, I'm just as likely to go to a bookstore that has actual books I can look at, either because I'm in a hurry and it's convenient or because I like the experience of being able to look around, as opposed to just ordering something off of Amazon. And I guess I'm wondering why this isn't really about adapting to changes in the marketplace and adapting one's business model to compete.
Well, you've got a whole range of consumers out there. And keep in mind that this is not a new tax, that if you buy the book from Amazon, you're supposed to pay a use tax on it. And in fact, you know, we have a couple hundred thousand people in Utah out of who do in fact pay use tax on their individual income tax returns every year. And we have a lot of businesses, you know, most of our big businesses are very faithful in paying their use tax. Some of our smaller businesses are, some of our individuals are, some of our individuals are not. But I think Mr. Norquist would characterize it as a lack of political will for us to go out and audit individuals for use tax. And there might be a particle of truth in that, but it's also horribly inefficient. If I send a 26-year-old kid fresh out of school with his accounting degree to go out and audit Mr. Norquist, he wants to look at everything Mr. Norquist bought, not just the things he's claiming are related to his business, but all of his personal consumption. So that's a very intrusive audit. That's a more intrusive audit than a typical income tax audit. Moreover, the guy spends a couple of days doing that, and he comes back with a check for $100. That's simply not good tax policy. That's not smart tax policy. That's spending more money to enforce the tax than we get for it. So that just doesn't make sense economically or administratively.
It's a tremendous
imposition on the individual consumer.
What doesn't make sense is for the 50 states, every one of them, that wastes money, that spends more money than they need to, that has everything from Minnie Davis-Bacon laws, which raise the cost of goods and services, to signing contracts with the labor unions with AFSCME that actually pay the state workers about 40% more than the private sector workers across the country on average, when you include pensions and benefits, as one has to because they're paid for by taxpayers. The idea that we should continue to raise taxes to pay government workers at the state level and local level 40% more, and that's before you deal with how many hours a day or a year are actually worked by those government workers, that we should be spending any time at all trying to figure out how to get a few more bucks out of taxpayers at the cost of federalism, that break down the idea that tax collectors in one state can go across and demand payment from businesses in other states 1,000 miles away. Why in the world would you break down federalism to do that when, in point of fact, all that does is undermine the very important role of tax competition? States should have to provide the best government at the lowest cost and compete for people to live in their states there and not reach across state lines and tax other people.
Well, when Utah adopted the streamlined sales tax project, they did it with the proviso that any additional revenue that was collected would go to lowering the sales tax rate. And I've got no problem with that. In fact, if states want to limit their spending, I've got no problem with that. But those decisions are made way above my pay grade. All I'm trying to do is collect the taxes that the legislature's given me in the most efficient and what I believe to be the most fair manner. Now, there's still going to be differences. I mean, Utah's rate, you know, our state rate is 4.75%. We have, you know, local rates on top of that. But if a state like Oregon wants to have no sales tax, that's great. And under the streamlined sales tax system, so a citizen of Oregon is still not going to pay any sales tax on anything. And that's great. And the states that want to do that are still free to lower their rates to make things, if they think that's an appropriate thing to do for their citizen.
Okay. Of course, the argument is that if states can reach into other states and demand that businesses in other states pay them sales taxes and corporate income taxes, and the new effort to argue that if you know, the fellow that, they thought something up in California moved to Nevada and they sent cops out to spy in his house because maybe he'd thought of his patent when he lived in California. That kind of cross-border rating is destructive of human liberty. We have had these panics before, pushed by the same people, mail order, everything's going to be done by mail order, we have to have the ability to demand people and businesses in other states to pay taxes to our state because everybody's going to buy everything through mail order catalogs. That was nonsense. The effort that everything was going to be services and nothing was goods, and therefore we'd lose all of this revenue. In point of fact, states are raising more revenue through sales taxes and through other taxes than over history. That little recession going right now, but otherwise continuing. And the idea that the high levels of state taxes and spending today, that our problem is that we're not raising enough money from people living in other states, is goofy. We need to be focusing on keeping taxes down. And this false idea that it's unfair competition, again, the shipping costs, Amazon has to ship to get stuff to its warehouses, just as a bookstore in Utah ships to get it to Utah. There's the additional shipping fee when you buy something on the internet. And unless you're selling jewelry or very expensive equipment, the shipping fees are always higher than the sales tax. So the unfair competition should be, if you really cared about that, you should be sending money to the internet salespeople, not the other way around, unless you're shipping diamonds or computers.
I think we are about out of time, so I want to thank both of our panelists for taking the time today to talk with us, Grover Norquist and Bruce Johnson, and I want to thank our listeners for listening. We hope you enjoy this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. And with that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.